I've had many spiritual experiences, and one of them was the moment that I was told I had 72 hours to live, because it was a very peaceful and calming experience, which I have no way of describing from a scientific perspective, other than the fact that I almost felt like there was some divine presence in that intensive care room.
Wow.
Because I'll tell you, I literally, after hearing that, bed and had somewhat of a smile. I knew that I was going to be okay. I had this strange feeling, this sense that someone's looking out after you, you're going to be okay. And I just said,
"The good life is one inspired by love and guided by knowledge. You'll find both love and knowledge here on The Misdiagnosed Life. Here is your host, Beverly Butler."
Dr. Neil Spector is a top Duke oncologist who's the lead researcher in personalized cancer therapies and who experienced a life-threatening illness that resulted in a heart transplant and led to the writing of his book, Gone in a Heartbeat, A Physician's Search for True Healing. And Dr. Spector, what happened that you almost died from Lyme, and when was this? Take us to the point where at one point you said you had 72 hours to live. Take us right up to that point and tell us what was going on.
So, I had symptoms for 4 years that were attributed to stress. And by the time I was diagnosed, with Lyme disease, I had permanent damage to the electrical wiring in my heart and required a pacemaker and a defibrillator, and then was found to have a severely compromised heart function from the standpoint of the muscle function. So I had what's called an ejection fraction, which is a measurement of the heart function that was about 10%, which is like driving a six-cylinder car and only having one cylinder function.
Wow. So the Lyme went to your heart.
The Lyme primarily affected my heart. So my situation was a bit unusual in that the initial symptoms were primarily cardiac or heart related, although I did have an episode of prolonged brain fog, which many of your listeners who have had Lyme disease may be familiar with, and I just described that as like taking 50 Benadryl tablets a day, just literally like walking through a cloud. I gave a lecture once on the research that we were doing in our group, and after an hour walked out and somebody said, "Gee, that was some really nice work you're doing," and I had absolutely no recollection of what I had just spent an hour talking about.
Wow, that's some major brain fog.
Yeah. So I lived after the diagnosis was made and I was treated another 12 years, again, with this severely compromised heart function, with a defibrillator pacemaker getting defibrillated many times along the way for potentially life-threatening arrhythmias, which is an experience I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy.
Right.
And then after, the summer or sort of late spring of 2009, so I had the pacemaker defibrillator implanted in 1997, so in 2009, I really went downhill rather quickly and ended up on a Friday evening in July being told in the intensive care unit that I had 72 hours to live without a heart transplant.
Wow. I bet that scared you to death.
It's an interesting thing, and I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I describe it in the book, but I'm a scientist. I've worked at trained at Harvard, worked at Harvard, worked at Duke, worked at, outstanding institutions, have developed two cancer drugs. So I'm a believer in the scientific method. But I will tell you this, that I, along the way through this journey of Lyme disease, which is now, 2 decades long since I first had my symptoms, I've had many spiritual experiences. And one of them was the moment that I was told I had 72 hours to live, because it was a very peaceful and calming experience, which I have no way of describing from a scientific perspective, other than the fact that I almost felt like there was some divine presence in that intensive care room.
Wow.
Because I'll tell you, I literally, after hearing that bed and had somewhat of a smile, I knew that I was going to be okay. I had this strange feeling, this sense that someone's looking out after you, you're going to be okay. And I just said, that's okay. Just transfer me to Duke, because Duke has one of the largest heart transplant programs in the U.S. And I had this feeling. It was a knowing. It was actually knowing. So, yeah, I wish, so it really didn't scare me to death. It may have scared my wife and family.
I'm sure it did. I'm sure.
But I knew that it was going to be okay.
Yeah, so maybe you just had one of those feelings that you had a higher purpose, that you were going through this for a reason. You know, sometimes that happens.
Yeah. It does. And, I've taken care of cancer patients for 25 years. And I've always learned, and I've always told people, so I've been in the best classroom seeing people deal with cancer and how they've dealt with it. And, time and time again, and something that I put to practice in the years that I was sick, which is, you can roll over and be a victim and woe is me, or you can go on and try to live the life the best you can and live each day to its fullest and, take your medicines and try to live a healthy life and not let your illness define who you are. And I saw that in the people that I took care of, and, was very inspired by so many people facing life-threatening, cancer diagnoses. And so when the time came that I needed to, heed the words of advice that I'd given out to people and the lessons that I learned, I mean, that's exactly what I did. I'm not going to lie and say there weren't times that I cried along the way and question, I did all the right things. I ran marathons. I never smoked. Like, why did this happen to me? But I'll tell you, they were very brief and few and far between. So, I did a lot of things, and again, with only a heart functioning at, 10 or 15% capacity, traveled the world, coached my daughter's soccer teams, exercised, developed 2 cancer drugs. So,
well, it's almost,
remarkable.
Yeah, it is very remarkable. And it's almost like you were, through your patients, it was helping to prepare you to go through, what you did so that you could go through it with bravery. Now, when did you first get Lyme? What year was it?
I got Lyme in 1993. And, I don't remember getting bitten by a tick. In retrospect, I may have had a rash that did not look anything like the classic rash, if you Google Lyme disease.
Yeah.
And that's not, right, that's not that uncommon. People are always looking for this nice target rash, which in 40-50, depending upon who you believe, percent of the cases does not happen. Some people don't have any rash. Some people may get bit in the scalp under their, under their hairline and not see anything. So I went to the, I lived in New England. I lived in the Boston area for 8 years. But if I trace back when my symptoms first started, I think I probably contracted the disease at the Delaware beaches, which is an endemic area as well.
Yeah, it is. At the Northeast is pretty bad for Lyme. We're going to take a pause real quick, and then we will be right back. You are listening to The Misdiagnosed Life on the America Out Loud Network, and I'm your host, Beverly Butler. And when we come back, we're going to learn more about Dr. Spector's story, plus we're going to talk about the things that Lyme and cancer have in common.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com to get all the latest. Make it a daily stop and also get the app. You go right to the App Store and download our free app, and that will put all our content right into your hands on your phones and your tablets. It doesn't get any easier than that.
Today I'm talking with Dr. Neil Spector, who's a top Duke oncologist who almost died from Lyme disease. And he says that Lyme is the infectious equivalent to cancer. And I'm going to ask him more about that in just a few minutes. But first I want to talk more about his near-death experience with this notorious disease that I think is affecting so many people and being misdiagnosed a whole lot. Now, tell us a little bit more about your symptoms that you had. What were some of your first symptoms you started having?
Sure. The first symptoms that I noticed were, really 3 major symptoms. So one was just extreme fatigue. So I went from running 10 miles a day, 6 days a week, and being in incredible shape over the span of a few months to barely being able to walk about 10 or 15 yards without having to stop just for complete lack of energy.
Wow, that's a major fatigue, but a lot
that was major fatigue.
Yeah, a lot of Lyme patients have the fatigue. That's a classic symptom.
Right, yeah. And when I tell and I tell people fatigue, sometimes people hear the word fatigue and it's, they attribute that to it's, you don't want to quite get up, you want to watch a movie, you don't want to cut the lawn. I mean, yeah, this is profound fatigue. This is not just I don't really feel like running 10 miles today. This is I can't get out of bed, I can't function. So
yeah, is it kind of equivalent to mono, the fatigue?
I never had mono, but I would imagine from what I've heard, it has to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it is just I cannot get my body to move.
Yeah. Yeah, I had mono as an adult a few years ago, and I knew it had to be mono because I felt so horrible. And I remember laying down, and I was so tired. It's like I felt like I needed to lay down, and it's like, but I'm already laying down, but you still feel like you need to lay down. That is a terrible fatigue. So I just wondered.
Terrible fatigue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was like one of the first noticeable changes. The second was I started developing palpitations. So they would be very temporary. I mean, they would last maybe 15 to 40 seconds. And they would just be this very rapid, out of the blue. My heart would go from, 70 beats a minute to 200 beats a minute, with, 70 to 100 being normal.
Yeah, that's got to make you feel terrible.
And it was incredibly frightening. So here I'm a physician, and they were not related to any strenuous activity. So, if you go running 20 miles, your heart's going to race. But I could just be sitting there, and all of a sudden, it would be like someone turned a switch on, and my heart would just start racing. I knew that there was something ominous and not right about that.
Yeah.
But it was the sort of thing that every time I went to an emergency room, and it could happen. There were times I was driving, and it would happen, and I'd try to find an emergency room, pull in, and every time I'd pull in, it would have resolved. And, it's like when you take your car to a mechanic, and, when you drive it, you hear all these clinging and clanging,
right.
And then you take it to a mechanic, it sounds fine, and they look at you like you're crazy.
Right. It never acts up in front of the people it needs to act up with. Yeah.
That's right. So so I had these palpitations, and then I had that episode of brain fog. Which again came, this was all in the span of probably 3 to 5 months of moving from Boston to South Florida. So I took a job at the University of Miami. And within that time period, I went from, again, being like this incredible, healthy specimen running 10 miles a day, 6 days a week, to barely being able to, walk 15, 20 yards, having, episodes of brain fog, and having these palpitations. And
so you went down when you moved to Miami.
I went down. And so one of the natural responses from physicians was, we checked your blood test, just the standard blood, your blood counts, your chemistries, your liver functions, everything's normal. We think that you're just having an adjustment problem going from the Northeast and, Boston to South Florida, which, it was an adjustment, but I had, and they said, well, you're stressed from that type of move. And I kept telling people, I've been stressed in my life. As a medicine intern in training, I had worked 120, 140 hours a week at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, an incredibly busy urban hospital. And I had never experienced anything like what I was experiencing then. So I knew that it wasn't stress.
Yeah. Did anybody ever mention to you about whether you possibly have a mold toxicity issue? Because I know me and my daughter were at a Lyme clinic for over a year in Florida, and 99% of his patients have what's called the mold gene, where they can't detox mold out of their systems. And he has noticed a lot of times when people go from a non-mold environment to a moldy environment, they get a lot sicker. And so I just wondered, did anybody ever look at that aspect of it as a possibly why you got sicker then? I was just curious.
Right. Yeah, no one ever mentioned that. The move to Miami, by the way, was temporally related to the trip to the Delaware beaches. So it it probably came on because we moved to Miami, and then shortly after we moved, flew to Delaware. And then after I came back, I started having those symptoms.
Okay, so that's probably when you got bit by the tick or something in Delaware.
Yeah.
On that trip. Yeah. Okay. I got you. Okay. So now how many doctors did you see before you got the correct diagnosis?
Oh, I saw, probably not as many as some people, but I probably saw probably upwards of 10 or 12.
Yeah. Yeah. Did all of them or just the last one or two do you had the Western blot or Igenix test, correct? To test
right.
for Lyme? Did they
Correct.
All do that, or just the last one?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm the one who forced them to do that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, you know, I had the same response when I even raised the question of Lyme disease, which is, we don't see that in Florida, even though one, it does occur in Florida, obviously.
Right.
And two, I didn't really contract it in Florida. It wasn't, if there were 10 diagnoses on their radar screen for me, probably 9 out of the 10 were stress. Lyme disease was not even on the top 10. So
right.
they
That's
weren't
typical.
Even thinking Lyme disease. Yeah.
Right. That's unfortunately so typical. So, but the test did come back positive when they did test you, right?
The test came back positive, right?
Yeah,
that's correct.
Now, did you have the Western blot or the Igenix? Because I know the Western blot test is a joke. I mean, it's so inaccurate. But the Igenix seems to be more accurate. Did you have that one?
I did have the Igenix. So initially, I had a test. I won't name the famous institution in the Northeast where the test was run.
Yeah, okay.
Because I thought that would be more reliable. Little did I know that was, probably the wrong decision. And then I had another test, which was also positive at the Stony Brook Labs. And then finally, I actually went to see somebody in New Jersey who at the time was very big into ILADS, was I think one of the original members, and she ordered the Igenix test, and that came back positive.
Okay, so basically a Lyme-literate medical doctor diagnosed you with Lyme.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. Now, how were you treated for it? And how long were you treated?
Yeah, so I was treated with ceftriaxone, so I had a PICC line put in. I got ceftriaxone for 3 months, and then I also got oral Bioxin. And so I was treated for 3 months. And
okay, with antibiotics,
With antibiotics. And at the end of that time, I had a lot of other weird, I had some symptoms that I think were more Bartonella related, although they didn't have good Bartonella tests back then. So I had this burning sensation in the heels of my feet that were so bad that I could barely, that I really couldn't put my feet down on any surface. So I had to sleep with pillows under my knees because just the slightest sensation would cause this incredible burning pain. That resolved. I had this incredible, again, just like the fatigue, I had insomnia that was well beyond just insomnia. It was just horrendous.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of other bizarre symptoms. The one thing, too, I'll just tell you that really, to me, nailed the diagnosis, but even with that, it wasn't clear to my doctors that I had it. So, 4 years into all of my symptoms, I developed, really for the first time, arthritis. And it was so bad I could barely lift my arms, and the joints were swollen. It wasn't just pain. They were, red, big. And I was prescribed doxycycline for a completely independent reason. So it was for something independent of the arthritis. And within 24 hours of taking it, the arthritis resolved 100%.
Wow. That's amazing.
It was amazing. And it was also around that time. So the last, so I was misdiagnosed from 1993 to 97. And probably from 96 through the time I was finally diagnosed, I started having, in addition to these episodes of rapid heart racing, I started to have episodes of very slow and irregular heart rates. And probably a few months before the diagnosis, I developed persistently slow heart rate, like a heart rate of about 40,
oh my.
Which, you know, if you're running marathons, that might be normal, but I wasn't running anything. I mean, I was barely walking at that point. And so I was diagnosed with third degree heart block again, which is classic for Lyme disease.
Wow.
And so that at the same time with this arthritis that resolved with doxycycline, in my mind, that sort of nailed, you know, this is Lyme disease. But it still took months and months, even after that, because I called the so-called experts in the Northeast, who flat out, without even examining me, Beverly, told me, there's no way in the world you have Lyme disease. I don't care what your tests show. You don't have Lyme disease.
Yeah,
that's what I was told.
Yeah, and folks, this is a guy. This is a doctor himself. He is a specialist, and other doctors are telling him he does not have Lyme disease when he knows he does have it. So now I did want to ask you. So just a regular layperson shouldn't feel bad, right? So now I do want to ask you. Now you talk like you probably had Bartonella. Did they test for any other co-infections?
They tested for Ehrlichia, they tested for Babesia, which were negative. But again, at the time, I'm not sure that there was a good Bartonella test.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I don't really know.
Yeah, now there's something that you've said before in an article. You said that there, which so many people, they just do not realize this, but when you talk about Lyme, you said that Lyme disease should be something that's considered as more than just one disease, because there are many different strains of Lyme, which most people don't realize, and that there's these co-infections that you can also get, so that most people don't realize. And you say that a person can get 5 to 10 different infections with just one tick bite, and that is so true. And I'm glad you brought that out, because most people just have no idea about that. It's not just one thing you're treating. Yeah. And so what should what should a person do if they, you know, get a bit by a tick and come down with Lyme disease? And I know there's a difference between acute Lyme and chronic Lyme.
Right.
But what would be your suggestion?
So my suggestion is pray that you find the right physician, number one.
I second that.
And don't stop until you find somebody that you feel comfortable with.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, finding that physician who's got experience is critical. I mean, that is so critical. And the problem is, you know, in contrast to cancer specialists, where, you know, where there are good people all around the country, I think finding that Lyme disease specialist who's good, and let's face it, there are people out there, sadly, who are taking advantage of desperate individuals. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can also go down the wrong path and find somebody who will gladly take your money and treat you inappropriately. So, yeah, this is a real cautionary buyer beware tale, which is really tragic, because when you're sick, and when you're sick, as people with Lyme and other co-infections tend to be, you know, the last thing you want to do is go shopping around to find the right doctor.
That's true, and it's so important to get the right one, and that's why people have to educate themselves also.
Right. And so I think that, you know, there are websites. There is ILADS, the organization, International Lyme Disease and Associated Diseases Society, where they can tell you where there are Lyme-educated physicians in your area that I think people should look at. I think it's important to ask others who may have had the disease, where they've gone, what their experience has been. This isn't something you just want to, you know, go to the Yellow Pages and find Dr. Smith.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
That's a recipe for disaster. So.
Yeah, but this is a life-threatening disease, and you have to be very careful as to how you treat it and what doctor you go to. I mean, I totally agree.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, you know, there are nuances, because this, you know, you raised this earlier and we can get to this, but I'll just make the quick analogy that we don't call cancer one disease anymore. I mean, no one believes cancer is one disease. No one believes breast cancer is one disease. It's dozens of diseases that are distinguished by their, you know, by their molecular characteristics. And so my contention is, when people say Lyme disease, it sounds like everyone fits under one little, the same disease. That is the farthest thing from the truth.
Right. It's so different, and it affects people in so many different ways. And like you said, there's different there's different strands of it, different kinds.
Right.
And I want to talk a little more about that. But I also want to talk about, and this would be a good time to you say you compare Lyme to cancer. So they have a lot in common, and I totally agree. As a matter of fact, I have to say this. I had a doctor tell me one time when he found out my daughter had Lyme disease, he said, oh my, he talked like, he said, I'd rather have cancer as Lyme. And I'd rather have neither, but he just was so familiar with Lyme that, but to me, in ways, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in so many ways, Lyme is so much harder to treat than cancer, it seems to me like. And but I want to go over you talk a little bit about your comparison chart and let's kind of talk about the similarities between cancer and Lyme.
Sure. So the similarity, which in my mind, which unfortunately, as I mentioned, the real world is not a similarity when people talk about it, is that just like cancer is really hundreds to a thousand or more diseases that need to be viewed in a very individualized, personalized way, treated that way, and not sort of a one-size-fits-all type of mentality, Lyme disease should be treated the same way and should be viewed the same way. I mean, unfortunately, it's not, and that's a big problem. So secondly is we know that cancer, if diagnosed and treated early, has better outcomes than cancer, which is missed and picked up at later stages. I think the very same could be true for Lyme disease. If you notice a tick bite, you get treated very early on, and there's some debates about, how quickly after that tick bites you that it takes for the bacteria to get into your body. There's some people that, would say 72 hours. I think it's pretty clear that it's probably a lot shorter time period that you need to be concerned about getting that tick off, and maybe 24 hours or less.
Right.
That bacteria may already be, inside and ready to spread. But
do you think Do you think people that's bit by Lyme should automatically try to have they should really have the tick, if they can save it, tested for Lyme, or should they start pursuing the Lyme testing right away, or what's your opinion on that?
Well, I think the Lyme testing right away is very misleading because it takes time for your body to develop an immune response. So I think the worst thing you could do is test very early on, notice a tick, go get tested, because it's probably going to be negative, and it may be negative for up to several, for a month or so.
Well, that's true, because the body has to build antibodies against it if you get it.
Right. So, so I do think it's worth getting, and there are services. So the Bay Area Lyme Association has contracted with a laboratory in Arizona. I think it's the University of Northern Arizona, that if you send the tick to, they will pay for it, and they will tell you what bacteria that tick has. I think that's very useful information. Even if it takes a period of time to get it back, at least you have that information, especially if you don't get better after your initial, round of antibiotics.
Because it's always always best to get it treated early, just like cancer. The sooner the better.
Right. So that's the second comparison. The sooner the better. The third is that I view I say Lyme disease metastasizes very early. So the spirochete, which is what the bacteria is, in general, it looks like this little corkscrew. And it can burrow into tissues. It gets into the bloodstream from the bite site and then out of the bloodstream very quickly and into tissues like the heart, like the joints, like the brain, where it is often very difficult to treat because you don't get some of those areas are not oxygenated, you don't get good blood flow, and so you don't get good levels of antibiotic to those areas. And I think, and obviously we know that cancer metastasizes. We used to think that metastatic cancer was just random bad luck. So why one person with breast cancer, a woman, might get metastases to the lung and the brain, and why somebody else might not get them at all, we used to think, well, it's just bad luck. Now we know that the reasons why some cancer cells end up in the liver, some end up in the brain, some metastasize to the lungs, is there's real scientific rationale. They're really directed there. They really home to those areas. And at least in the laboratory, there's evidence that the Lyme disease bacteria, Borrelia, that some strains are more prone to going to the heart, maybe like the one I had. Some are more prone to going to the joints. Some may be more prone to going to the skin. And so, again, there's method to the madness, just like metastatic disease. Why some people get cardiac manifestations and others don't, why some people get joint manifestations and others get cardiac, I think is written into the biology of this disease.
So do you think it's the bacteria themselves that have a pre-programmed path they want to take, or do you think they're going to the weaker areas of the body, or do we know?
I don't want to say it's 100%, because there's never all or nothing
right.
in human biology, but I think that it may be written into the different strains and what attracts
okay.
them to certain sites.
Okay, so there's some kind of an attraction to a certain site.
Exactly. And, you know, and that's important, because in cancer, when we start to learn about those attractions to certain sites, we can start to think about, are there therapies that we can develop to block that attraction? Because what kills people with cancer is not the primary tumor, by and large. It's not the tumor in the breast. But it's when the tumor in the breast gets to the lung and the brain and the kidney, you know, and the liver. And so if you could block the metastatic spread, we can take care of the primary tumor. And I think the same could potentially be said for Lyme disease. If we could understand why some go to the heart, some go to the joints at a very molecular level, why can't we do the same thing that we've done with targeted therapies in cancer and try to figure out how to block that?
Yeah, that makes sense. But so medicine really doesn't know what is attracting them to these certain areas. That hadn't been figured out yet, correct?
Well, it's been in animal models, it's been figured out.
Okay, what is that? What's attracting them?
Well, there are proteins on the bacteria, and there are proteins in the heart tissue and proteins in the joint. With different strains that may, you know, predict for which strains go where because of those attractions.
Okay.
So some of those are known. They're not known in humans because we just, you know, it's very difficult to culture the bacteria from human beings.
Yeah.
But in animals, it's quite clear that, again, there's, you know, rationale for why certain strains cause heart problems and don't cause joint problems, and other strains cause joint problems and not heart problems.
Yeah. Okay. So how do you see Lyme being treated and cancer for that matter? Is more targeted therapies? Do you think Lyme will start being treated like some of the stuff you're working on with cancer in the future? Or where do you see it in the future?
Yeah. So let's take cancer as a starter. So cancer historically was treated with, you know, chemotherapies, with very toxic chemotherapies
right.
that were rather nonspecific in their effects. So they didn't just affect the cancer cells, but, you know, you lose your hair, you have problems with your GI tract, you have problems in your bone marrow, it causes, you know, drops in your white blood counts that increase risk of infection, your platelets increase risk of bleeding. So there was really no targeted nature to the historical chemotherapies that were used. We've come around, and some of the research that I've been involved with is really, you know, targeting is understanding the wiring of tumor cells and trying to understand how the wiring of tumor cells differs from the wiring of normal cells, and then target tumor cells selectively. And that has really transformed, you know, many of the treatment of cancer. So, you know, HER2 positive breast cancers, there's an antibody called Herceptin, which is really revolutionized the treatment of that once highly deadly disease. Melanomas, you know, there are targeted therapies, certain types of lung cancers. I'm not going to say that we've done enough, because we still have a ways to go. Too many people are still dying of cancer, you know, every day and every
right.
year. But we have really transformed. We have come from just giving drugs, which literally almost killed people, to now saying, how can we do this smart? Now, the analogy is that in Lyme disease and in Bartonella, in the co-infections, I view where we are today with those diseases as where we were 30 years ago with cancer. We're still taking a hammer and trying to hammer away
right.
with more antibiotics. And, you know, and antibiotics are powerful drugs. I mean, anyone who's taken multiple antibiotics for a long period of time, many Lyme disease patients have taken them for years, knows that this isn't like taking a baby aspirin or taking, you know, your vitamin C.
Right.
These
antibiotics do so much damage to the body, you know, kills the good bacteria and all that. And there's so many repercussions for that. Yeah.
Exactly. So they're not, and in fact, many of the antibiotics were originally developed as cancer therapies.
Well, I didn't realize that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So they are. Yeah, and some of the cancer therapies were antibiotics, were identified from antibiotic families. So we need to be, and I think the real deficiency here, and one of the areas that I'm trying to promote and perhaps we'll get involved with at some point soon, is to try to take the lesson. So the big area in cancer now is our drugs that can unleash the power of the person's own immune system.
There you
right?
go.
Jimmy Carter had metastatic melanoma to his liver and brain and got a drug that was not chemotherapy that essentially took the brakes off the immune system. You know,
yeah.
The holy grail in cancer has been, why doesn't a person's immune system recognize a cancer as being foreign and eliminate it?
Right, and that's the heart. That's the heart of it, because everybody in medicine knows if your immune system's working like it should, you shouldn't come down with these.
And actually, if you look at some of the cancers, and if you look under the microscope, what you see is the immune system is trying to eradicate the tumor. So there are immune cells in the area of the cancer, but they just can't get there. The
wow.
brakes have been put on the immune system. And now that we've identified what the brakes are, we can develop drugs to take the foot off the brake.
Okay, what are the brakes?
Immune system.
What are
so
the brakes are
a family of proteins. They're called checkpoints, immune checkpoints. One is called PD-1. There are about four, and new ones are being discovered. There are multiple PD-1 inhibitors, so antibodies against the brakes that are now approved for melanoma, for certain types of lung cancer, for bladder cancer, and some others that will be. So there's, in each type of cancer, there's a percentage of people in some cancers higher than others that will respond to PD-1 inhibitors. And I think the question now is, you probably need more than one inhibitor, and so now there are going to be combinations. But that is the biggest thing in cancer therapy. And the question is, why does the body not recognize an infection like Lyme disease? And
right.
perhaps, the same mechanisms that are at play that allow cancer cells to evade the immune system, the bacteria may take advantage of those same systems. And so we need to look at that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got drugs that are approved for cancer. What if they are effective in some percentage of people with chronic Lyme disease? I mean, it would be a shame if we missed that opportunity to understand that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I like what you're now. Typically, I've just been so against the typical cancer therapy with they just take the shotgun approach and give them chemo
right.
and radiation, because, I mean, those are so dangerous. The body doesn't need more attack. But the one thing that I do like is and I'm not just saying it because you do it, I really believe this, is the targeted therapies. If you can take
right.
if you can take it and target it and just get that cancer or maybe one day the Lyme itself and leave the rest of the body alone and maybe give the body, like you said, immune boosters and things to help support the body, then I think that is a phenomenal combination. And I also wanted to ask about what you thought about the diet. Now, there's a new diet a new diet craze. It seems like this goes through waves, but I really like this one myself. It's called
uh-huh.
a ketogenic diet, and I know they're using that for some, along with, treatment. Now, it's not by itself, but using this
right.
ketogenic diet along with some cancer treatments to treat cancer patients and having them do it, which, of course, is a high, healthy fat diet and a real low carb. And the idea
right.
is you starve the cancer cells. And I think this is something that's good for Lyme, too, because all the bad bugs and the bad things like the sugar and the carbs. So if you have
right.
that low, you can starve it out. What's your thoughts on that in combination with, to me, if you have a diet that can starve the cancer and Lyme out, you boost the immune system and you have targeted therapies to actually attack the Lyme and the cancer and whatnot, to me that's a really good combination. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that I think anytime you can eat healthy, and we clearly eat too many carbs and the wrong carbs. I mean, there's nothing wrong with fruits and vegetables, but and in fact there's good things about those. But the other bread and cakes and all the other stuff that we tend to eat in a Western diet are probably not good. So I think that the other similarity when you mention the diet is that the Borrelia bacteria, the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, has what we call it, you know, we like to call a sugar addiction, just like cancer cells.
Yeah.
They are heavily addicted to glucose. And in fact, their metabolic requirements are very different than normal cells. And people have tried to take advantage of that in, like you said, treating cancer. So I think there's a lot to the diet that, you know, we could take advantage of when it comes to, you know, in conjunction with other treatments.
Right.
I do think that the real transformation and the breakthrough is going to come when we just take an out-of-the-box approach to the treatment of Lyme disease and start saying, rather than adding a fourth and a fifth and a sixth antibiotic, which are, in my mind, are not going to be that effective and will only cause more problems, let's take a very smart approach and do what we did in cancer and start developing targeted therapies against the bacteria proteins and also figure out how we can unleash the immune system.
Yeah, that's I totally agree. And when you said take an out-of-the-box approach, I am a big-time out-of-the-box thinker, and I think we have got to start thinking outside the box because look where we are and look where the box
right.
has gotten us, you know. And so I wanted to, before we close, I'm going to talk about your book here in just a second, but
sure.
What, you know, there's a lot of people out there that still suffering from Lyme, and you know, I wanted to just ask, how long do you think Lyme can be cured one day? And what would you like to tell people that are out there suffering from Lyme now?
So I tell people this all the time. If we can cure some of the cancers, if Jimmy Carter can walk around cancer-free, and I'm not just using him as a sole example, but if we can cure some cancers, I mean, I never thought in my lifetime I would be able to say to somebody with metastatic lung cancer, you know what, we have a treatment that could potentially cure you now, or melanoma, which was a death sentence 10 years
right.
ago, metastatic. So I would say if we're talking about curing those diseases, we should be able, I refuse to believe we can't cure Lyme disease or Bartonella or any of the others. We may not have, so I would say, what I say to people is, and I say this to cancer patients, do whatever you can to stay healthy, because there are new treatments that are going to be coming down the road. There's new research. I would say this to your listeners, if they want to do something very proactive, to write their congressperson, because there is not enough money for Lyme disease research from the federal government.
That's totally true there.
It is,
absolutely.
It is woefully, woefully behind. $20 million for a disease that affects at a minimum 340,000 people a year, which is more cases per year than breast cancer, $20 million is nothing.
Right.
And so, you know, what we need is a war against Lyme disease. Just like people are talking about the war against Zika, we need a war against Lyme disease.
That's true. Amen to that. Yeah. And I totally agree with you, because I think there is hope. I refuse to believe that there's not, because there's so much research in so many different areas. Tell us about your book, Gone in a Heartbeat, and where can people get it?
Sure. So you could get it on Amazon. You can order it through your bookstores. They may not stock it, but, you know, Barnes & Noble, you could order it. Independent bookstores, will order it. I wrote the book. It took 15 years to write, and there was really, it really wasn't until the transplant, because I couldn't think of a good ending until the transplant. Mm-hmm. And people ask me, why'd you write it? I wrote it initially almost as a therapeutic exercise. You know, I wrote it as a journal to chronicle my feelings. I tape recorded, emotional experiences I had along the way. And then as I gave talks, primarily to cancer survivors, and told my story, people started encouraging me and said, you really need to write a book about this, because it's really a book, yes, that's important for people with Lyme disease, but it's beyond that. It's really a story of perseverance. It's a story of trust yourself, you know, trust your gut instincts. It's a story of living with a life-threatening illness, but going out and doing, a fulfilling life. I mean, as I said, I developed two cancer drugs, living with a sword hanging over my head that I could have died at any moment during that time, and had several episodes where I probably should have died.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, yeah, it's a story that, you know what, that you could face some of the worst things in life. And, you know, it's a very cliche-ish, but when you dealt lemons, you can make lemonade. You know, as I told my patients and as I learned from my patients, you can roll over and die and just say, woe's me. Or you can dust yourself off and say, you know what, I can overcome this. I can live each day to the fullest, realizing that no one has a guarantee on anything. You know, I told people 3,000 people went to the World Trade Center one day. I'm sure they all thought they were coming home that night. And, you know, things happen. We don't know why.
Yeah.
So, you know, but with this disease, you know, one of the lessons and one of the sad things is that if something like this could happen to me, you know, a scientist who trained at the top tier institutions, who does research, if I could be dismissed, imagine what's happening to other people out there.
Exactly.
Who, you know, don't have medical knowledge. So you really, really have to be your own advocate in what has become a very complicated and often, to be honest and sadly, a very impersonalized world of medical, you know, the healthcare system, where doctors spend less and less time with patients and more time fixated on a computer screen.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Spector, for taking your time. You've just got a wonderful story, and I want to encourage everybody, especially if you're dealing with Lyme or cancer or any chronic illness, this is a book of tremendous encouragement, and it'll help keep you to help encourage you to keep going. But get his book, Gone in a Heartbeat. You can get it at the major bookstores. And again, thank you, Dr. Spector. I really appreciate your time, and I'm so glad you're here to tell us your story. You're a real genuine and kind man, and I wish you the best. And I also want to thank everyone for listening. And this is Beverly Butler, and you've been listening to The Misdiagnosed Life on the America Out Loud Network. Be sure and subscribe to iTunes and rate and review the show. We'd love to hear from you. And don't forget to download the America Out Loud iPhone app. And as always, take care until next time.